matter what hour your clock strikes here, it's always Halloween. And I'm always your haunted host, Luce Tomlin Brenner. Welcome to Small Frights Friday. On these episodes, I like to share a curated selection of calls from the All Hallows Hotline and letters from the Eek mailbag. This week, we got a barrage of Eek mails, so it's going to be a very letter-heavy episode, but let's kick things off with a call.
Hi, Luce. Long-time lurker, first-time caller. This is Jacqueline Chicos. You got it right the second time in your Theater Ghost episode. It's like boys in Spanish, but it's a butchered Hungarian spelling. Ellis Island, am I right? I don't have much to add, except I'm so happy I found this show. It's scratching that Halloween itch. I was raised by a spooky woman who's like part Stevie Nicks, part Frida Kahlo, but she passed away in 2015, and since then I've had been like diving headfirst into those traditions I've been ignoring. I really appreciated the episode on Dia de los Muertos. I'm in the Sonoran Desert, so even if you're not Latina, you get kind of wrapped up into the celebrations and parades. I guess one thing I would add, on the super scary side of things, if you really want to keep yourself up for days, is to look into tales of skinwalkers. Skinwalkers, and like, I don't even like talking about them, are the Diné or Navajo twisted witch creatures that do exactly what their name implies. They also lend their name to the famous Skinwalker Ranch in Utah. That has less to do with scary things and more to do with aliens, but that's also a really fun dive. Anyway, I am really happy to be supporting the show. I'm a proud Halloweenian or trick-or-treater pumpkinhead. Hauntween? I don't really care. I'll use them all. Thank you.
Jacqueline Chicos, I'm so happy that you called and that I was correct when I said your name at least one time. I said it correctly, and I will now commit it to memory. Please, anyone else who calls or writes in, if I mangle your name, feel free to correct me. I want to do it right, I promise. Jacqueline, I'm so sorry to hear you lost such a cool caretaker. She sounds like an incredible woman. Stevie Nicks and Frida Kahlo are a powerful, heady mix. And I'm delighted to hear that you're able to still hold up your own traditions and you're, you know, thriving in your practice of them. And I know it's so hard to do that when you, you know, lose a force in your life like the one that you describe. But as I'm sure you know and you've thought of before, but we're doing traditions that are something we used to share with loved ones. We're keeping their memory alive by keeping them going. And, you know, eventually, hopefully we'll be able to pass them on to other younger people in our lives, and they will keep that memory going in that way as well. Something that I love about Dia de los Muertos is that lineage passing down among family and friends and keeping each other's memory thriving. Thank you also for touching on skinwalkers. That's not a legend that I'm super familiar with, so I had to look it up. And I had a hard time. I was really looking for indigenous sources so that I could make sure I was getting very, you know, true and accurate information from the people who this actually, their own beliefs, their own folklore. But I had trouble doing that, and then in doing some more reading, I discovered it's because Native Americans don't like to talk about skinwalkers, which I really appreciate. It is said here in this article by allthatsinteresting.com. This was actually the best one I could find that wasn't just kind of opinion-based. It looked like it had more research to it, and it was less sensationalized, which is always what I try to look for, especially when I'm looking to learn about other cultures that are different from my own, is primarily, you know, look for a primary source, look for information from the culture that you are trying to learn about. And if you're having trouble with that, you know, look to a scientific or historical intellectual source. that is, not in it for the likes, I guess. We want to, if anything ever seems sensationalized and you got to click around and find something that's a little boring, a little more dry, that's how you know it's closer to being accurate. All right, so allthat'sinteresting.com says that little is known about skinwalkers, as the Navajo are staunchly reluctant to discuss it with outsiders, and often even amongst each other. Traditional belief portends that speaking about the malevolent beings is not only bad luck, but it makes their appearance all the more likely. Which is always what I've said about ghosts and why I don't like talking about them too much, because I don't want them to think that means I'm welcoming them. So I can really appreciate this line of thought and I want to be respectful to it. And I just want to reference one other thing here. I didn't know about this, but I guess J.K. Rowling got herself in some more hot water when she, used skinwalkers in one of her stories. And Native American writer and historian Adrienne Keene explains, one of the aspects to why that's problematic. She says, "What happens when Rowling pulls this in is we as Native people are now opened up to a barrage of questions about these beliefs and traditions. But these are not things that need or should be discussed by outsiders." So, all that to say, I'm not going to get super into skinwalkers because it seems as though Navajo people don't appreciate it. And the last thing I want to do is wade into an area that is disrespectful, go over anything that, I'm not welcome to be there. So if you guys want to Google a little bit and do some of your own homework and your own reading, definitely go for it. But since this is a podcast with thousands of listeners, I don't think it's fair for me to get any type of attention or likes or anything talking about someone else's culture when they are out there specifically asking us not to. And Jacqueline, that's not any kind of judgment on you at all. That's a personal choice that I want to make since this is my podcast. But I thank you for sharing it with us. And thank you so much for being a Patreon Ghoul Gang member. Your support helps us make these episodes, actually. We're almost at supporting a full month of Small Frights episodes on Patreon. That's incredible. It makes such a huge difference. So, Jacqueline, you rule. Thank you so much. And let's get into some of our eek mails. Okay, the subject of our first letter is "Welcome Back." Hi, Luce. I always save the Small Frights episodes for when I go back to work on Sundays. I'm off on Fridays and Saturdays, so it was wonderful to hear you again today. You asked us about how us pumpkinheads, I'm not giving up on my name idea, haha, keep Halloween alive on a daily basis. Personally, I always buy a big bag of caramel apple suckers during Halloween, and I keep them in my locker at work for when I need a Halloween fix. Thanks, Tony. Tony, yes, I love the caramel apple suckers, and I actually do the same thing. I buy a bunch of bags around Halloween and then slowly eat them all year round. This last October, I was noticing some weird hate that the caramel apple pops were getting. I don't understand. They're definitely one of my favorite Halloween candies. So are there people out there who legitimately don't think those taste like incredible caramel apples? Because it's just blowing my mind. That's just like this Christmas I learned a bunch of people don't like candy canes. I don't understand. Maybe I'm just into suckers more than the average person. So I'm wondering, if there was any candy out there, what would you guys want to eat all year round? Like if you could get Halloween candy all year round. I personally, my favorite are the Reese's pumpkins, which, you know, technically you can get around any holiday because they're like the Reese's hearts or the Reese's eggs are suspiciously similar looking to the pumpkins. You could even carve a little jack-o'-lantern face with an X-Acto knife onto your Reese's egg, and voila, you have an even better Reese's pumpkin than what they gave you in October. So possible spring candy craft opportunity for all of you pumpkin heads out there. Tony, I love the name Pumpkinheads. It wasn't one of the major losers. It was definitely a fighting name up there. We've got even more name suggestions on this episode, which is terrific. I love it. And I love that Jacqueline in the call was like, I'm all of them. That might end up being what it is. Am I grasping too hard for one nickname? I just thought it would be fun. I'm just trying to have fun. Maybe I just need to let it happen more naturally. Stop forcing it. See what happens on its own. Tony, thank you so much for that sweet note. Tony is an illustrator, and he does these really cool black and white pet portraits. So go check him out on Instagram. It's at TonyDixon_art, and ask him about his commissions. I think that's such a cool personal gift to get someone. All right, our next eek mail is titled BGSU Ghost Stories. Hi, Luce. I have two ghost stories to share from my time at BGSU. For everyone listening, that's Bowling Green State University. We've actually had a couple of calls about BGSU, which was my alma mater. So I love that more fellow Falcons are calling in to share their memories. And please, you don't have to have gone to college in Northwest Ohio to call in about a college ghost story, but it helps. No, seriously, anywhere you went to college, anywhere you went to high school, like any cool ghoul school, oh God, I'm out of control. Any cool school ghouls you know about, you should write in. Oh my God. All right, let's get back to the letter. I have two ghost stories to share from my time at BGSU. I also remember hearing about Alice, the University Hall Theater ghost, while I was at BG. One evening in the fall of 2000, I was outside my dorm smoking a cigarette when a friend walked up. He was shaking and looked like he wanted to faint. He told us he had been on a walk, which included going past the fenced-in cemetery, and while walking, he heard a gentle clinking sound. He looked up at the fence surrounding the cemetery, and he saw a man in a suit inside the fence holding onto it. The man's pocket watch was dangling by its chain, and the wind was gently knocking it against the metal fence. My friend said he was wondering how the man got stuck inside when it hit him, that this was a ghost. He ran back to our dorm and told us all about what had just happened. While he was telling us the story, he realized that his walk had somehow taken about 20 minutes longer than it should have, despite not having stopped, and he sprinted back after his experience. Oh my gosh, that sounds like some lost time right there. I know that as an alien, you know, alien abduction legends are that you can lose time, but I don't know about lost time when it comes to ghost stories. Listeners, please let me know. Okay, back to the letter. The second ghost story involved the young boy at Cole Hall, which I saw personally. I worked overnight at the front desk at Cole Hall from 2002 to 2003 before there were renovations. All of us who worked there had been told about a young boy who haunted the area behind the front desk and the open use space nearby. Occasionally, you'd look at the front desk area and feel like you had just seen him, but I always chalked it up to the fact that I worked from midnight to 4 a.m. Oh God, the scariest time. One night, it was different. Down a short hallway that faced the area our desks were located, there was a door with a small glass window. That night, I was working with another person, and something in the window on the door caught both of our eyes. It was a bright light. The longer we looked, the brighter it became, until it became the shape of a person's head and shoulders staring at us through the window in the door. Both of us looked away, terrified to see what was going to happen next. After a few moments that felt like hours, the light dissipated, and we finished the rest of our shift. Although I continued working there for several more months, I never had another sighting. Thanks for the trip down BGSU memory lane, Luce. Jenna. Jenna, those stories are extremely upsetting. My goodness, that's so scary. Kudos to you for taking the graveyard shift at the dormitories. I would not have been able to handle that. I would have been much too scared. And I never walked past the BGSU cemetery at night or ever by myself when I had to take that road to get to one of my biology classes. I'd only ride my bike, and I always did it on the other side of the road. Listen, I love cemeteries, but I don't spend a lot of time in them by myself. So happy you're enjoying the podcast and all the BGSU memories, Jenna. Thank you so much for sharing that eek mail with us. And listeners, send in your cool school ghouls. Ow, I got it that time. All it took was a little practice. All right, this next eek mail is titled Trick or Treat. My rules when it comes to the age of trick-or-treaters is they only have to have a good costume. You can be a full-grown adult with no kids, and as long as your costume shows some Halloween spirit, you're getting some candy from me. Physical effort is good, but a clever costume that was easy to make is also perfectly acceptable. The low-effort costumes like, quote, college student or, quote, hobo are the ones that aren't good enough. It's very easy to just add some fake blood and a knife, and then at least it's a costume. If your costume doesn't pass muster, then you only get candy from me if you sing the full unabridged rhyme nice and loud. Trick or treat, smell my feet, give me something good to eat. On a related topic, I want to give my two cents on trunk or treat. I think it's almost exclusively a church event, though you could put a survey on your website for people to weigh in. Anyone can do trunk or treat, but I think 99% of those hosts are churches. One thing I actually like about the activity is that it is usually during the day and often not on October 31st. So it's not in direct conflict with trick or treating. It's possible to do both. So I'll count trunk or treat as just bonus costume fun for this season. Though anyone who only does trunk or treat is missing more than half the fun of the season. For me, neither trunk or treat nor trick or treat is about the candy. It's about seeing great decorations and incredible costumes. Also, I have some name suggestions. I thought to make it a little more distinct, we could include your name. What about Brenner's Boo Crew, the Brenner Boogeymen, Tomlin Terrors, or my favorite, we could be Lucia Lanterns. Thanks for the podcast, Jay. Ha 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 ha! Well, listen, if you're going to give me suggestions like that, you know I've gotta love them. I vote 100% for Lucia Lanterns. I also really like Tomlin's Terrors, which is very cute. And if I ever decide to have kids, a great built-in nickname. Hey, it's very flattering. I love this idea. I'll throw them out there with all of the other suggestions. I'm going to do an Instagram poll, so check my stories. If you're not following us, it's at It's Always Halloween Podcast on Instagram. And I always put fun surveys and stuff in the stories, so check those out. Go vote. We'll see if we get another name. And hey, listen, don't let the fact that I am selfishly rooting for Lucia Lanterns affect the way that you vote. Jay, what a fantastic email. I loved it. I love the flattery. I think you're right about Trunk or Treat. We actually got yet another Trunk or Treat related email that I'm going to get into next. But I think that's such a great point. Why judge it? Why not just do both? Enjoy all of the Halloween activities that you can get your claws into. I also love that you have these very specific trick-or-treat rules. I think that the rhyme, trick-or-treat, smell my feet, give me something good to eat, is criminally underrated these days. I haven't heard it for years, which is why it made me laugh so hard when I read that. So I think you make a great point. Put on a costume, doesn't matter what the age is, just put a little fun into it. I agree. When people come to my Halloween parties and they're just like, my costume is I'm sleepy or something like that, I am very close to kicking people out. Listen, this is not just a party. This is a Halloween party. You gotta get into the spirit or you gotta go. You could drink at a bar down the street. You don't need my beautifully, ornately decorated and themed Halloween party. Get out of here, you lazy bum. Ooh, sorry, I had a little flashback there to some disrespectful Halloween guests of my past. Jay, thank you so much for this awesome eek mail. And I'm interested to see if Lucille Lanterns will stick. All right, next I have a little shout out to Becky, who sent me a really cool YouTube video by Biographics, which is they do short, like 15 minute videos on history, totally up my alley. I hadn't heard of them before, but I subscribed. And the video she sent me is called The Pixie Sticks Killer, The Man Who Killed Halloween. I'm going to throw it all in the links in the show notes for you so you can check it out too. It was really well produced. I loved it. It's about Ronald O'Brien. I've talked about him in past Small Frights episodes, but he was convicted of murdering his son by lacing his son's Halloween pixie sticks from trick-or-treating with cyanide in order to get his son's life insurance payout. So check out that video in the show notes. The host links the nationwide panic O'Brien triggered over poisoned Halloween candy to the creation of Trunk or Treat. The idea, of course, being that it is safer to exchange candy with people you know. Of course, in the O'Brien case, that is not accurate. And the data on children who are victims of violence shows that children are much more likely to face danger at home or with someone they know than with a stranger. Paul Renfro, a history professor at Florida State University, wrote a book last year that's on my reading list called Stranger Danger: Family Values, Childhood, and the American Carceral State. He examines the damage done by the frenzy of stranger danger and satanic panic, which squarely aligns with the still persistent fear around trick-or-treating. Renfro recently wrote an article in the Washington Post about the link between this 80s hysteria to modern-day QAnon hysteria, and I'll link this article in the show notes also. It's called QAnon Misdirects Our Attention Away from the Real Threats to Children. Now, I've said this before in many different ways, but I want to underscore it again. I think the exploration of history is important because it helps us understand our modern world. Halloween isn't in a vacuum. The ways in which we celebrate our favorite holiday is directly related to big issues like class, ethnocentrism, and the criminal justice system. If we want to understand current issues like why is trick-or-treat waning and trunk-or-treat rising, then we have to shine a light on some of these dark corners. And we have to demand that people examine their fears more critically. Moral panics around Halloween can seem quaint or silly, but when they line up with dangerous conspiracies, we can see them for the serious missteps that they are. I want to wrap up this section by referencing Joel Best, a professor of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware, who's best known for his work banishing the myths around Halloween sadism, one of my new favorite phrases of all time. On his website, he references the 5 cases that have been attributed to Halloween sadism in the past. And I want to dive into those real quick with you right now. I'm also going to link to his website in the show notes if you want to read more about Halloween sadism, which I know you do. Okay, here are the 5 deaths attributed to Halloween sadism. 1, Kevin Totson in Detroit in 1970. 5-year-old Kevin died after eating heroin supposedly hidden in his Halloween candy. Less heavily publicized was a follow-up story that Kevin had actually found the heroin in a relative's home. It had nothing to do with Halloween candy. Number two is Timothy O'Brien, who we're just talking about in this episode, from Pasadena, Texas. This was 1974. 8-year-old Timmy died after eating cyanide-laced Halloween candy. Later, the investigation revealed that he had received the candy from his father, who had also taken out a life insurance policy on him. The father was tried, convicted, and executed for the murder of his son. Number three, Patrick Wiederhold, in Flint, Michigan, 1978. 2-year-old Patrick died after eating Halloween treats. However, tests of tissue samples failed to find traces of drugs or poison, and police concluded that Patrick's death was actually from natural causes. Number four, Ariel Katz in Santa Monica, California, 1990. 7-year-old Ariel collapsed while trick-or-treating and died. Although her parents told the authorities that she had heart problems, the initial press reports blamed Halloween sadism. The coroner attributed her death to an enlarged heart. And number five, an anonymous 4-year-old girl in Vancouver, British Columbia in 2001. She died after eating some Halloween candy, leading police to advise parents to throw out all of the Halloween treats. However, pathology tests showed no evidence of poisoning, and the autopsy showed she died of a strep infection. So, again, trick-or-treat candy has never been linked to death. An analysis of pediatric holiday-related injuries in emergency rooms found that among the 8 major holidays, Halloween ranked number 4 in the number of injuries behind Labor Day, Memorial Day, and 4th of July, and just ahead of Easter. So there you go. Of course, there are concerns about pedestrian injuries, getting hit by cars, that kind of thing. But as we see, that's just as common on many of the other major holidays. So no reason to extra fear Halloween above any other holiday except for possibly Labor Day, the most dangerous holiday, according to this journal in Pediatric Magazine. So again, I'll link all this info in the show notes so you can be armed with facts the next time someone tries to sell you on their anti-trick-or-treat rhetoric. That is going to do it for today's episode. Thank you so much to everyone who called into the All Hallows Hotline or wrote into the Eek mailbag. If you have a Halloween memory that you want to share or you want to learn a new Halloween fact, then give us a call. It's 802-532-DEAD or drop us a line at itsalwayshalloweenpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Instagram at itsalwayshalloweenpodcast. Please tag me in anything you think I'll find interesting. I've learned so much just from the things that you guys send me. I'm loving this back and forth intellectual experience we're all having. So please hit me up. If you love It's Always Halloween, please subscribe on Patreon like Jacqueline Chicos. I'm offering 5 delicious candy tiers inspired by the joys of trick-or-treating and trunk-or-treating, I guess. And your support means more time for me to create more material for you. Right now, as I said, our listeners are producing almost 4 Small Frights episodes a month, which is incredible. You basically have covered all the cost of what it takes to produce a month's worth of Small Frights. So thank you. This could not be possible without you. If you want to support us, please go to patreon.com/itsalwayshalloween. Today's episode was written, researched, and performed by me, Luce Tomlin Brenner, with some incredible help from our contributors. The editing, theme music, and sound design is by the marvelous Pete Burns. Thanks so much, Pete. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at LTB Comedy and Pete at Mittenberries. If you're on Apple Podcasts, please subscribe and write us a little review so that other like-minded ghouls can find us. We're also on the NPR One app, so subscribe to us there and tell Ira Glass how much you love us. Thanks so much for listening to It's Always Halloween, and come back next time, my little Luceo Lanterns.